hope everybody's comfortable and warm and dry now. Let's start by praying, ask God to bless us our time together. Dear Lord, we thank so much for life in Christ, a morning to worship you, to learn from you, a wise God, our Redeemer and Creator. We ask that you bless our time together now, in Jesus' name. Okay, so the first two times we were together, we looked at some chemistry of life, and we discussed, we tried to argue, based on a lecture of Dr. James Tour, the idea that the impossibility from chemistry point of view of stuff just bumping against each other and come setting up and form and exist and creating life. So now we move a little bit towards the information. What's information? So you saw code of life, the life the library that tells how to put things together is on something called DNA, discovered by two guys in the late 50s, and everybody's marveled since then on what it is and how it does it work. So let's dig a little more into that now, into information. Where does it come from? As Christians, we are on this side of the screen, God, logos, spoke, and everything came into existence. On this side is just nuclear subparticles bumping and boom, and start gluing together and building up atoms and so forth, big molecules, and we're here talking after a few billion years later down the road. So that's where we are. So we're building up a case. Where does it come from? I like to start with Psalm 111, 22-4. It's beautiful. Great are the works of the Lord, studied by all who delight in them. Full of splendor and majesty is his work, and his righteousness endures forever. He has caused his wondrous works to be remembered. The Lord is gracious and merciful. Isn't that amazing? That God created, and he said, I'm not going to let these people forget that I made this. So, the same way we saw last couple times, we look in Romans chapter 1, that because God made them known, caused it to be known, the psalmist is saying, he causes his wondrous works to be remembered. It's all over. The planet is all over our lives, every day we are in this world. So, what's the essence of information? Anybody? Let's give a try. What's the essence of information? From the mathematical, philosophical point of view, it's about the same thing.
A bunch of data mixed together.
Okay, you're saying what's information? A bunch of data together?
A bunch of data that is organized in such a way that you can understand it.
Who can understand it?
People.
People around you.
Yeah.
But can you talk to your dog? Does he answer you?
No. Well.
Well. You say don't do this or do that, and he obeys you.
No.
Not all the time, okay. Some better, some better than not. But we marvel to see dogs, you speak to them, they sit down, they obey you, right? So we have to,
okay.
What's the essence, what's the information?
Order.
Order. What kind of order?
Order that contains a message.
If you look at that crystal, right? We eat every day table salt. is this guy here, right? Then in the crystal, we have another like this, and up here, we have another one, down here, we have another one, and then here, and then, and so on. And this, of course, comes in three dimensions back there. So that's very ordered. Is that information? Well, I have information there. How much?
Order with a message.
Super ordered, super organized. It's kind of a hard task to come up with what's between the essence of information. Another try.
I have to disagree with John and Steve here. Coming from a computer science.
Exactly, let's go.
We talk about a bit. And a bit, when you get down to it, is either something is or something isn't. It's either true or false. It's either on or off. It's one of two states. And information, I don't think, has to be necessarily understandable. There's a whole, you have to, and I don't think it has to necessarily be ordered either. When it comes down to that little minuscule bit, that's a piece of information, and it's not a bunch, and it's not necessarily in something that you might understand due to some inherent order in it. I think you have to apply things to get to that knowledge state where there is order and there is understandability. But at the basic level, I think somebody said it over there, it's something is either truth or not truth.
True or not true, the essence of information.
Something is either true or not true. It's one of those two states.
Okay, one more try, and then
there's a lot said during this sickness about essentials. You got the word up there, don't you, essentials?
The essence, yeah, of information.
And I am all the time thinking of Francis Schaeffer, as he would lecture, and he would speak about, just in a general way, he would speak about truth. And then you would qualify
true
person.
Truth. He used the expression truth. Yeah.
True truth. Yeah. So that comes to mind,
So information.
Of information.
Okay, God spoke. That's the truth. That's a lot of information there. But when you go to that, the next couple of classes, we're gonna talk about more towards like the scripture and information. Put them together. Go ahead.
Real quick, just thinking of a property of information. Kind of building off what Eric was saying, but just the sense that it's independent of the medium, right? It's abstract, so this notion of off-on binary,
okay. It's
not dependent on...
So information is not, let's start by saying information is not. Information is not matter. Information is not energy. Energy can carry information. Turn on your radio, guys talking to you on the radio, that's energy, bringing the words, carrying the information, but it's not information. The book, the computer, the screen here has an information to us, but it's not information. It's kind of tricky, very simple thing. We do every day, Look at this information bump against us all the time. But if you reduce, we're going to discuss a lot about this next couple of Sundays, but the core, I just want to put this, and then we're going to let this sit in our minds, and then we're going to watch a video and go for it, but then we're going to come back to this. The essence of information is this. Interesting, huh? Information, the reduction of uncertainty. If I give you this information, tomorrow 6 in the morning, the sun will rise. How much information I'm giving to you? Zero, because did I reduce the uncertainty that the sun is going to rise tomorrow for you? Tell me something new, right? What's new?
Well, you did say the time.
Huh?
You did say the time, we might not have known that.
Say it again?
He did say the time that it was going to rise. We might not have known that.
Oh, it's something that is going to happen. So you're not reducing anything. You know, when you're informing me that the sun is going to rise tomorrow. If I tell you this build is going to crash on our head in the next 30 seconds, what is that? Am I give you a new piece of information or not?
Does it have to be a new piece of information?
It has to be what?
Does it have to be new?
New. No, it has to reduce the uncertainty of what's going to happen. So this is very interesting to think in this line, and that's very important to, you know, to discuss the idea of information. So let's watch this video. Steve Myers on Discovery Institute. We talk about in the new show that discuss a little bit the idea.
Decide the debate about biological origins is precisely the question of the origin of information. If you don't have instructions, if you don't have information, you can't build anything in life. Everyone who works in biology knows that information is needed in order for a living cell to do what it does. On the other hand, there's this huge mystery surrounding information, because we also know as humans that information doesn't come from nowhere, it has to come from somewhere. So you have this big question mark in the origins question in biology: where did all the information come from? Completely void of animal life. Then, within a geologically brief span of perhaps 10 million years, the waters were suddenly alive, teeming with a riot of complex animals, representing most of the major animal body plans that have ever existed on our planet. Known today as the Cambrian Explosion, this mysterious episode in life's history was familiar to Charles Darwin, who regarded it as a disturbing challenge to his theory of gradual and unguided evolution by natural selection. During the past century, the mystery of the Cambrian explosion has deepened as scientists have discovered the central role played by biological information in the history of life.
The Cambrian explosion is not just an explosion or the abrupt appearance of many new forms of animal life. It's also an explosion, or would have required a huge infusion or generation of new biological information. Biological form requires biological information.
Scientists' understanding of biological information advanced dramatically when Cambridge University researchers James Watson and Francis Crick made a startling discovery. They found that the structure of the DNA molecule stores information in the form of a four-character digital code. Strings of precisely sequenced chemicals called nucleotide bases supply the assembly instructions, the information, for building the crucial protein molecules that living cells need to survive. Crick later came to realize that the chemical constituents in DNA function like letters in a written language, or digital symbols in a section of computer code. Just as English letters convey a particular message depending on their arrangement, the sequences of chemical bases along the spine of the DNA molecule convey precise instructions for building proteins. The arrangement of these bases directs the arrangement of the 20 different kinds of amino acids that make up protein molecules. Proteins, in turn, perform a vast array of critical jobs inside cells, catalyzing reactions, processing genetic information, and forming the structural parts of molecular machines and other biological structures. Building new animals requires many new protein molecules, and building new proteins requires new biological information.
I used to ask my students a question when I was teaching. You want to give your computer a new function, what do you have to give it? And they would know. They would say code, or software, or instructions, a program, all those are the correct answer. To generate a new function in the computer, you have to have code, you have to have instructions. The same thing turns out to be true in biology. This is the great discovery of the second half of 20th century biology, that information is running the show in biological systems. To build a new form of animal life requires cell types, requires proteins, and therefore requires genetic information. And that's the big question that the Cambrian explosion presents. If you want to think about how to build an animal, how would these animals get built, you have to have some explanation for the informational requirements of their construction.
According to modern evolutionary theory, new proteins and new forms of animal life arise through random genetic mutations sifted by natural selection. But in an alphabetic text or a section of computer code, random changes typically degrade meaning or functionality and ultimately generate gibberish.
As we've come to appreciate the digital or typographic character of genetic information, it raises some really interesting questions about the efficacy of that mutation-driven mechanism. And we know from computer code, for example, that if you start making random changes to a section of computer code, you're much more likely to degrade the information that's there already than you are to come up with a new operating system or program.
This problem has long been recognized by computer scientists, mathematicians, and engineers, including a group from MIT who convened a now famous conference at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia in 1966. These scientists met to consider whether the random mutation natural selection mechanism could conceivably generate enough biological information to build a new animal or even a new protein in the time available to the evolutionary process. One of these scientists was MIT engineering professor Murray Eden.
No currently existing formal language can tolerate random changes in the symbol sequences which express its sentences. Meaning is almost invariably destroyed. Murray Eden, MIT.
Eden knew that random changes to alphabetic or digital characters inevitably degrade the information in any section of alphabetic text or digital code, and for a very good reason.
Whether you're talking about digital code in a software program or a section of text in an English sentence or book, or the genetic text in DNA, there are vastly more ways to arrange the relevant characters that convey the information in a way that will produce gibberish than there are that will produce function or meaning.
Eden and his colleagues suspected that the genetic code faced a similar difficulty. When it came to producing new genetic information, at least enough to generate a new protein, the random mutation natural selection mechanism had to deal with what mathematicians call a combinatorial problem. In mathematics, the term combinatorial refers to the number of possible ways that a set of objects can be arranged or combined. In genetics, the combinatorial problem poses a severe challenge to the random mutation natural selection mechanism. To understand why, imagine a thief who would like to steal a beautiful new bike. All that stands between the thief and the bike is a lock with four dials, each marked with the numbers 0 to 9. But there is only one correct combination that will set the bike free.
The reason a bike lock works is that there are vastly more ways of arranging those numeric characters that will keep the lock closed than there are that will open the lock.
A thief without knowledge of the combination must guess the right combination from among 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 possibilities. That's 10,000 possible combinations, which usually would be more than enough to defeat a random search for the one right combination. Yet there is still a way the thief might succeed. If he has enough time to try enough combinations, he might eventually identify the right one by chance. For example, if trying each combination takes 10 seconds, then in 15 hours, an especially diligent thief could try more than 5,000 combinations, or more than half of the total possible combinations. In that case, he would be more likely to succeed than to fail in opening the lock. But now imagine a much more complicated lock. Instead of 4 dials, this lock has 10 dials. Instead of 10,000 possible combinations, this lock has 10 to the 10th power, or 10 billion possible combinations. With only one combination that will open the lock out of 10 billion, it's much more likely that the thief will fail, even if he devotes his entire life to the task. So what about relying on random mutations to search for a new DNA sequence capable of directing the construction of a new functional protein? Would such a random search for new genetic information be more likely to succeed or fail in the time available to the evolutionary process? In other words, is a random mutational search for a new gene or protein more like the search for the combination on the 4-dial lock or the 10-dial lock? The scientists at the Wistar conference were unable to definitively answer that question because at the time, no one could adequately quantify how hard the search problem was.
So in the late 1960s, one could make these arguments based upon analogy to things we understood, written language, computer code, but we didn't have any experimental data to show whether those analogies actually suited the biological case. So no one could come up with the exact numbers to answer these questions back then.
Molecular biologists at the time did know that the number of possible combinations corresponding to any given sequence of DNA is extremely large and grows exponentially with the length of the molecule in question. For example, corresponding to one short protein 150 amino acids long, there are 10 to the 195th power other amino acid arrangements of that length. That's an unimaginably large number. But scientists in the 1960s didn't know how many of those arrangements were actually functional. They didn't know, in effect, how many combinations would open the lock. That didn't stop evolutionary biologists from speculating. Many argued that there must be a high proportion of functional sequences among all possible sequences, so that a random search for a new functional sequence would have a high probability of success.
The way they did that is to say, well, maybe biological sequences are not nearly as finicky, not nearly as picky about which characters are where as written languages or as computer code is. And so that's the track that they took, that maybe proteins don't really care which amino acid is where, and there's a great deal of variability, and therefore you can have the same function performed by a huge number of protein chains and a huge number of genes.
But recent experiments in molecular biology and protein science have replaced speculation with data. These experiments have established that DNA-based sequences capable of making functional proteins are in fact extremely rare among the vast number of possible sequences. Just how rare? After working at Cambridge University, molecular biologist Douglas Axe set out to answer that question, using a technique called site-directed mutagenesis. His experiments enabled him to estimate that for every DNA sequence that generates a functional protein of just 150 amino acids in length, there are 10 to the 77th amino acid arrangements that will not fold into a stable three-dimensional protein structure capable of performing that biological function. one correct sequence for every 10 to the 77th power incorrect sequences. That's equivalent to searching for just one combination on a lock with 10 digits on each of 77 dials. To put this in perspective, keep in mind that there are only 10 to the 65th atoms in the entire Milky Way galaxy. Could random genetic mutations effectively search a space of possibilities that large in order to find even a single functional protein sequence?
So given that you have this very daunting probability, 1 in 10 to the 77th power, how could something that improbable happen? Well, as we know generally with improbable things, the way that they can happen is by having lots and lots of opportunities for them to happen. So for life, those opportunities take the form of individual living organisms in which a mutation could occur that could conceivably provide the solution. No matter how rare it is, if you get enough of these opportunities, it can become probable. So the question is, if the number is 1 in 10 to the 77th power, if that's the improbability that must be overcome, would the number of organisms that have existed on the planet since the beginning of life come close to matching that number? And it turns out that it doesn't come anywhere close.
During the entire 3.5 billion year history of life on Earth, it is estimated that only 10 to the 40th individual organisms have ever lived. Yet 10 to the 40th power represents only a small fraction of 10 to the 77th power. Only 1 10 trillion trillion trillionth, to be exact. In other words, for even a single functioning protein fold to arise, the mutation selection mechanism would have time to search just a tiny fraction of the total number of relevant sequences, 1 10 trillion trillion trillionth of the total possibilities. It follows that it is overwhelmingly likely that a random mutational search would have failed to produce even one new functional protein fold in the entire history of life on Earth. Of course, the building of new animals would actually require the
uniform and repeated experience, another key idea from Lyell, that is capable of producing information is intelligence. Whether we're looking at a hieroglyphic inscription or a paragraph in a book, or a section of computer code, or even information embedded in a radio signal, whenever we see information, especially when we find information in a digital or typographic form, and we trace it back to its ultimate source, we always come to a mind, not a material process. So the discovery that information is running the show in life, the discovery that there are these huge infusions of information in the history of life, such as the one that occurs in the Cambrian explosion, suggests that a designing intelligence has played a role in the history of life. And it also suggested to me that it was possible to formulate a scientific case for intelligent design, that is, a case for intelligent design based on the same scientific method of reasoning that Charles Darwin had used in The Origin of Species. And so if you want to say intelligent design isn't science, you would have to say that the Darwinian argument in The Origin of Species is also not science. But no one really wants to say that. He's not using an unscientific method, he's just using a different method of scientific reasoning, an historical method of scientific reasoning, and I use that exact same method in formulating the positive case for intelligent design in both Darwin's Doubt and in Signature in the Cell.
Munch on that and say, oh, okay, what exactly means this and this or that. So, what comes to your mind, what impressed you the most when you watch this? Anything new?
Well, you have to be a detective, and you have to go backwards and find where that information came from.
What's the word Mayer used?
Forensic.
Forensic style.
To find out who the murderer is.
We leave a lot of traces behind, though. I bet when you arrive at home and you look at, and then you know that your wife is not there because she leaves some clues behind when she leaves. We all do this. You know, we leave things that we can research and find out, you know, even not knowing exactly what happened.
So, what he was talking about, it wasn't even a cell. Right?
Protein,
which makes up.
Well, proteins is the,
right in the, cell.
The building block that makes everything. You can so look at your cell and say, we are proteins walking.
So how much protein is in a cell?
In a cell. A cell is built by proteins.
Yeah.
Everything is protein in the cell. Different kind, hundreds and thousands of different proteins. So this is, we're gonna talk a lot about this. So you know, protein, you know, block, how to build a new protein. You need new proteins to build new animals. So it's matches like this. If I put 1,000 cement blocks here, what can you do with those 1,000 blocks? Oh, I can make a wall here, a ceiling here, maybe a balcony. You can things, many things you can do with 1,000 blocks. Different shapes. Now, what about if I put 10,000 blocks here? Okay, more, you know, more options to make different things. So think of proteins like that.
Wouldn't the probabilities that he was discussing be even more unlikely, because not only would every new protein have to overcome those amazing probabilities to actually be created in order to create an animal or even a cell, they'd have to be all created at the exact same time. Is that correct?
Or a cell replicate somehow?
It has to be made for a reason. So this is a problem. But of course, you see, we don't see nature, you know, that happen that we see. Because there's change. We always change. There's mutation happening. So there's new protein because everything is changing. So you can see from, let's see, let's reason with the Bible, for example. When God created all, every animal, he created each kind, right? But what's a kind in biology? So this taxonomy, that's what the word used in biology. The Bible, in Genesis, we see that I think Adam was the founder of, the of biology. He gave name to all the animals, right? So he goes on around it and name it each one that he founded. And you can see that the complex of this system of building things, you really need information behind everything. Because you cannot do anything without some. You see the how he builds up the case, mentioned computers, the digital language. The more you mess up with a program, the less likely to go anywhere. You know, you just start kind of deteriorate things, not build up new things. To build a new animal, that's what you need to do. But back in the beginning, probably God only create a wolf. Canine. That's the kind. And from there, you have all together about hundreds of different dogs in the world today. It's all dog. You know, we don't leave the kind. You have a tiny, what's the name of the tiny little dog? Like a toy.
Chihuahua.
Yeah. And then you can get a German a shepherd or what's the name of the bigger one?
Great
game. So you look at, those are the same thing? It's a dog? How can it be possible? It's amazing, you know. It's all because of protein changes, mutations happen. It's an amazing thing, it's very complex. But it doesn't leave the kind. So that's the thing about it. Anything else? Numbers scared you a little bit? What's 10 to the 77th power? What the heck is that? It's a big number, right? No. Which means, you know, this means it has 77 zeros behind here. How much is that?
A lot.
He said that the whole Milky Way galaxy has 10 to the 65 atoms. So the combination, just to find out one protein is a correct fold, we're going to discuss it a little later because it's a lot of stuff. The numbers are a little bit like, wow, that's not.
I'd like to know how they got the
10
to the 65 atoms.
How they figured that out.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all statistics. Look at star, you know, star density. Some kind of extrapolate, you know, make averages, things like that. It's not precise.
So one way to look at that 10 to the 77 is, so that's that's like a trillion, right? 12, 10 to the 12th is a trillion, is that right?
So
10 to the 77 is 1 trillion Milky Way galaxies.
It's an amazing, ridiculous number. Yeah. But
the other thing you're talking about with the dogs, like God created them in kind, they're kinds, so like cats, dogs, bears, whatever. But it implies then that the information for every kind of dog was in the original dog.
Yeah, it was built in.
Recessed things that weren't necessarily manifested in a particular animal, but then some information over the years would have gotten, say, reduced. So like Chihuahua could not
go back to become a wolf.
Exactly. Yeah. Chihuahua
very good.
A wolf. So it's loss of information as opposed to
a beautiful polar bear, white, can never go back to become a brown bear again.
Right.
Where do you think from? Unfortunately. Go ahead.
And, you know, going back with the number stuff with the complexity, like, I think I remember this may be a little bit outdated, but when I was back in, with the science classes at, you know, back when I was in school, I remember, like, talking when they were talking about DNA, how complex it was, where if you wrote it in not just small font, but like tiny font, if you wrote out the sequence of just a single person's, it would stretch to the moon and back, and maybe then some. And it's just like, that's one person. And you have to figure out every, like, how many billion people are on the planet now? It's just like, and you have to figure out all the people that came before, and it's just like, it gets to that whole, like, you know, it just reminds me also how they talk about the scientific method, like back in school. It's just like, if you were just think about the scientific method with like degrees of error, it's just like, you just think about it and it becomes statistically absurd.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Numbers are really interesting, you know. This is a pin. This is the pinhead, right? A pinhead has a volume about 1/16 of an inch cube. If you pack DNA on that, solid DNA, how many books do you think you can put in terms of information on that? 1/16 of an inch DNA, 10 meter, you know, 100 feet high books stacked fits there. A mile high stack of books. From here to the moon is 385,000 kilometers. You go back and forth 500 times, that will be the stack of books that fits here. So this is so much technology back in terms of density of information, DNA, that's so much beyond what we can think of making today in technology. So this is unbelievable.
Right. Kind of a related question. How do Darwinists explain that if we evolved as human beings from monkeys, why are there still monkeys?
Say it again. Why?
Darwinists. The evolution of man from primate, monkeys. Why are there still monkeys then?
The explanation is kind of interesting. Remember that you have mutations. So you have mutations in one branch. It branched off from the initial one, but the initial one kept going. It's just the one offspring that started going to that direction, the other didn't go. So that's the explanation. So, information. Back to information. Anything else want to add anything? Go ahead.
While watching it, it just really struck me, like, the awe that we can have in our God. Like if he is in control. He holds all of that in his hand, and it's like nothing for him to do that. But in our mind, like, it's just infallible that, I don't know, to me, it just like really struck me, like, of course we can put our trust in a God who understands that easily when it's mind-boggling, you know, to me, for sure. Other people probably have a better, you know, ability to grasp, but yeah, just when we go through struggles, when we go through trials, like, we have a God that we just wholeheartedly put our trust in and know that He is holding it all together. And I don't know, it's just very, very precious, I think, to us believers that we can have, see that in our Savior.
When we start a class, one of the goals that would be to glorify God better. Because we see the heavy weight of His glory in all of us. We see this, we saw this in Psalm 111, wondrous works. And now, look at this. Inasmuch as man has undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us. It seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely to some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught. Who wrote that? Luke. So what's the reason for the information he's putting together very orderly?
Certainty.
Or to reduce our uncertainty. You want us to be sure of what happened. So that's God's business, is making sure all the time that we know what happened, so we can believe and trust Him. And through nature, one revelation, and the other revelation, the written word. Okay, so let's keep going and reviewing this. So this DNA code, beautiful 4-character digital code, right? Is made of actually two polymer DNA. So they get together, they form this twisted, that's how they call it is. And we talk about how big it is, you know, the volume of this thing. It's all located in the nucleus of the cell. We need it to copy things from it. So what's the reason to have DNA? DNA is just a information storage. Things there, you need to. But it doesn't matter, like, this computer has a lot of stuff here, but we have, how we get out of there? This is kind of, we can have a book here. We have to open up to start reading. And then secondly, you have to understand the language which was written. So there are many things involved in information. Very beautiful the way, very instructive about the videos. Okay, so a little more down again to a little bit of chemistry, not much, not like the other classes. So all these things are together. Remember, in form of two strings of DNA, they get together and always connect, you know, those two letters, GCTA. And this is, you look at this, it's so much in here, and that we don't mention because it's all chemistry, blah, 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 blah. But when you talk about a lot of the chirality, remember, another, last Sunday, the homochirality of these guys, and the inductive spin, which is an amazing thing that happens, speeding up, you know, electrons back and forth. Now, in the last few years, there's a new thing called epigenetics. Because they're finding out that around the cell, these sugar structures, like, they connect on the cells and create a magnetic field with different polarity, different charge. And that, together with DNA, has info. Eat well, sleep well, exercise is valid more than ever. So just you're, you know, increasing the problem with information. It's all over and more than you can imagine. Now it's not only inside the DNA, but even in the cells. A little bit of what's going on inside. So this is the two, you know, guys come together. They're replicating. So they have to put this connection all the time. A lot of stuff can go wrong, right? And if it goes wrong, there's a mechanism to repair. But this machine is so efficient that makes a mistake for every big number here. For every 10 to the 7th, every 10 million nucleotides put together correctly, it makes one mistake. This is show how efficient what's happening inside the cell. It's an amazing mechanism.
Is it the topoisomerase that makes that does the corrections? I'm trying to remember.
Say it again?
Is it the topoisomerase that does the correcting? I'm trying to remember which one.
No, it's the mechanism for correcting?
Yeah.
No, it's not here.
Okay.
No, it's just the putting together and copying here.
Okay.
Back to the protein construction. You saw those walking stuff. What's going on there? You see that moving? So, a little. Okay, so. The DNA is in the nucleus of the cell, the guy here. But the cell is this huge thing, right? So this thing, creating proteins, is not exactly, you know, not inside the nucleus. You have some other stuff. You have comes a guy here, it comes out, it's called mRNA. So it's a message. So it goes there and copies a chunk of the area it wants to copy. And then it goes to big things called ribosome. And inside the ribosome, there's a tRNA. This tRNA carries this big structure, right? With this guy here. In the end of it, it has one of those nucleotides.
Amino acids.
So there, as this guy goes in there, it transfers the code it copied from this guy, so this guy can go, read it, and okay, let the amino acid connect it, leaves, and then to the other, So this is what's happening, that's what they're showing here. So the building of the protein is only 100, the Dr. X experiment showed, he built only, in his experiment, because it's very hard to do it, with the 105th amino acid, the primary structure, which is a very small protein, which basically that's a catalyst in the cell, something like that, for this kind of size. That's what he was talking about. So in the, what's in this guy here is those sequence of letters. So every time we have a, these three letters will mean, so you have the first letter, the second, the third, so you look at the sequence, so all of the six is always gonna produce a glycine on that. And another interesting thing is, how this machine knows when to start to make something and when to stop to make something. Why does it start making this and never ends it? Because it's all information. So every time you have an AUG, that's the beginning of creating a protein. And then when it finds a UGS, it means stop. Those two guys, stop, make it. And then the tRNA pulls back the amino acid and leaves it. So this is like, whoa. This is start looking more than the GMs and assembly lines in Detroit, you know. Probably even more sophisticated, a lot more sophisticated than that. But then we talk a lot about evolution, we talk about mutations. What's in the mutation? So a mutation is exactly the problem when you have inserted and delete one or two nucleotides and change this reading frame here, cause an incorrect protein to be produced. So what happens after that, you know, sometimes, most of the time, the protein just is destroyed in the cell. And all the amino acids goes back to store to be reused. So all these mechanisms is happening all the time as we're sitting here. So that's one of the reasons we don't have cancer all the time. It's because our body's self-correcting problems all the time. It's one of these amazing things happening inside us.
How long did these sequences get?
Go ahead.
Go back to that last one for a second.
Uh-huh.
So the top table is basically what each three letter combination turns into as a protein or term. What are those building blocks?
The building blocks are amino acids, the base one.
Okay.
There are 20 of
those. Like, how many of these three letter combinations? These are all present in the mRNA. It's just one big long string.
Yeah, when it goes into DNA, the nucleus, it copies that.
And how long does that get in terms of sequences, three-letter sequences like that? How long are we talking? Are we talking hundreds of sequences long, thousands, millions?
Well, it depends on the protein that you want to build.
Varies a lot. You know, it goes for just a couple hundred to a thousand of amino acids in one protein. It copies, you know, genes, you know, mm-hmm. sections of the DNA. That's where, you know, the order to make it, the protein there.
And the incidence of mutations is, you said, generally one in...
I didn't see that, but it's...
10 to the 77.
No, 10 to 7.
7, sorry, 10 to 7, you're right.
It happens, a mistake. Yeah.
So every 10 million sequences, there might be a mutation involved.
not mutation. Mutation, it's bringing...
There might be a different sequence coming out.
The wrong information from the nucleus.
Yeah.
The number, the 10 to the 7 is problems here when the tRNA is transferring, connecting those guys. It's, you know how many tRNAs transfer the amino acid to the sequence is happening in 1 second? They figure out between 700 and 1,000 in 1 second, inside the ribosome. As we're talking here, this is what's happening inside us. This is just a quick, beautiful view from, I think, the National Science Foundation. A little bit of the information, the transferring, the ribosome machine, the cell is a complicated thing.
Is that a real image? Is that a real image?
No. This is all random. Another...
That's a video. That's from a video.
So,
a machine, a molecular machine.
Yeah. So, okay. We'll build some here. Some stuff here, right? Now, it goes where? How does it get there? The protein doesn't know. You have to have some information to what to do next. So we have other machines. They will transport, like robots, into the different parts of the cell. You stay there until everything else is ready to move out of there. And you look at this and say, wait a minute. So this is, you have to build this in order to have the function to do this for the cell to function. So the cellular machinery problem is the most sophisticated thing we have in the universe, in life, everything. It's what's going on in there.
Seems like you have machines within machines.
Oh yeah, that's called the machinery, you know.
Right.
Big stuff, you know, big complex stuff. And everything starts, you know, inside one code, one book called DNA. But the question, our question is, where does it come from? All this information. This is just a beautiful picture about cells reproducing right in the beginning. This, I forgot the name, what's this?
Moiling.
Yeah, the eighteen cells.
Yeah.
Imagine the code of this, and everything to be perfect, because in another 3 or 4 days it becomes an embryo. If you put a magnetic field strung around this, a lot of things can go wrong. So this, what happened that he mentioned? So, back in the history a little bit. So all this DNA stuff is coming to science in the 60s, and people are thinking, wait a minute, what's going on? So, wait a minute, what? Darwin's mutations, natural, you know, unguided. But now we're seeing all this information, as we know, books, everything, you know, you cannot disturb, you cannot throw letters by chance, it doesn't form a sentence. So, well, can you save Darwinism? So, we saw these guys all came to Philadelphia, to Wistar Institute, inside of the heart of a UPenn, and they sat down to discuss this. But in the 60s, they didn't have all that we know today. But this guy from MIT said this, no currently existing formal language can tolerate random changes in the symbol sequence which express sentences that we just saw happening. Meaning, it's almost invariably destroyed. So, they understood the problem, but they chose to keep it going towards somehow unguided mutations kept happening in previous life. Without any evidence, they pushed towards that.
That was in the 60s?
Yeah, the 1966 in Philadelphia. Big meeting. Big brains came to Philly to discuss the problem. Can we save Darwin? Actually, going back to history, the Darwinian theory was basically completely destroyed from the 1870s to 1920, because Darwin said that when you mix the one explanation to create new things is the breeding. He gave an example of breeding a bird with a white wing with a bird with a red wing, and all of the, you know, becomes offspring will be pink, and then it kept going on, and then everybody starts, well, if that's true, all of the birds would be pink in the end. There'll be no white or red. So Darwinism just went down. But back in the 20s, everything started changing when they started understanding better genetics with Mendel, and you start, you know, doing experiments with peas. And that kind of brought back this called new Darwinism from the 20s.
When they discovered recessive genes.
Say it again?
When they discovered recessive traits.
Yeah.
Skipping,
that saved. No, this is the explanation that Darwin didn't have, and that's what's behind everything. So, this is our 150th amino acid protein. It's a small guy, not a big. So, what happens is, remember, it's all the machine putting them together. Here. A protein. Remember, all the structures are 3D, and they twist. This is called primary structure. Then it slowly goes to secondary structure and tertiary, which they call folding. It folds into this. And there's water molecules all creating charges of pushing against or getting together. All of this is very important, this final shape, because there is only one place, and only that something's gonna happen to this protein. I gave the example of our blood. Our hemoglobin is much, much bigger than this, thousands of amino acids. It's only one place, the heme group, which is one atom of iron in the middle. That's where the structure, where the oxygen is going, connected. And connect in such a way that the binding energy cannot be strong because it has to super fast when it delivers to the cell. It cannot be too light, it might lose in the middle of the way. So just to show one of the, you know, the complex of the stuff, you know, the mechanism of chemical reactions all over. So this folding is a big problem because it has to fold precisely. If it doesn't fold precisely, it doesn't have the function correct. So one amino acid that's wrong here is going to change the shape of the protein.
Do all amino acids with the same instruction set, I guess, they all fold the same way? It's not like a random folding pattern.
Amino acids is a little bit like this.
Given a perfect replication of this amino acid, do they all fold the same way if they have the same instruction?
No, they fold similarly, but so the amino acids like this. Our group is the sugar, the big rings here. There's a proton here, right? Hydrogen atom. If this thing keeps pushing sometimes here, so then it becomes this, or it goes back. In other words, there's charge floating with this proton all the time. Mm-hmm. So in amino acids, so this interferes. Whatever is the R group that gives different, the 20 different ones, because the R group is different. So that, and remember, as we have different polarity, water will go around this and raise this thing of pushing or not, or be together. So this is big role. And remember, I mentioned a little bit about hydrolysis, how water, which is creates life, also can attack life. So water can is so small that sometimes it has energy and shoots to break some of the binding there. And it needs repair mechanism for that too. But water is very important in giving the structure and all this too.
What is man that he's mindful of us?
But God made us on his image. So he wants us to build all of this. He wants us to put in the garden and told Adam, take care of him, work hard. That's the cultural mandate that we're following. It doesn't matter if you're a believer or not. You're doing our job. That's the beauty of the Reformed theology. Discover this, remember this, back in the Middle Ages, important people was the priests in the church, some other rich people, everybody else. And then Reformation came and discovered the beauty of God's creation. Every single person working in society contributes to a lot. It doesn't matter what you do. So, what's happening after the meeting, the year's coming now, getting closer to what we are now, and there's a lot of new evidence, and there's kind of a break now in several fronts among biologists questioning the creative power of natural selection. You can see this in many meetings, articles. This one mentioning epigenetics. So some saying that we are in a post-Darwinian biology now. Others say that this is not true. We're firmly strong on Darwin. But look at this guy. This guy, Dan Tufik, from the Weizmann Institute in Israel, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv. He's a strong, Darwinist, but he's a very good protein maker. He just passed away, he died last year. Evolutionary theory ascribes inventive power to natural selection alone. However, natural selection cannot actually invent because it can only home in on the fitness signal from an invention that after the invention already exists. So, you need to have an invention, and then probably natural selection can do has a role in there. But without the initial invention, how are you gonna? Okay, what happens? Natural selection, as the word says, selects from what? for possibilities. But there's nothing for before to select. There's nothing to look at. Natural selection push forward, though. This is one example that a guy is not a Christian guy, you know, call atheist, I don't know. This shows that there is problems in the theory today. This is an article from New York Times showing. This is back, I think, in the Scope trial. No, Scope, no. Open, back in 20, here in Pennsylvania, what's the name? Small town. It was 2004, 2005. What's the name of that trial? It was famous for the debate. The federal judge ruled in favor of striking down the teacher of ID in schools.
Is it Dayton, Ohio?
Say it again?
Dayton, Ohio.
No, this is Pennsylvania.
Oh, Pennsylvania, I'm sorry.
I forgot the name of the town. But just showing that this is never stopped, it's just growing, growing. The dissidence from Darwin is just growing more and more. So he mentions these two guys, Darwin and Lyell. So who is this guy? Remember, you know, guys? Have you heard about this guy? He's a brilliant mind geologist. So they're contemporary, kind of one help the other. I play a joke that those kind of are, it's like the two watches. You know, there's this story of this guy who had this work for 40 years in this company, and all lunchtime he fixed up the clock in the company so everybody could go out to lunch together at the same time. But for years, you know, this is like 56 years ago, so he looked out the window, there was a store across the street, you know, and he looked at the big clocks that the guy put on the street for sale. So he said, oh, it's 10:26, so he goes to the clock in the company and 10:26. And then the alarm goes out, so everybody goes out to lunch. But then the guy in the store hears the alarm, you know, going out, and he goes, oh, it's 10. Fixed his clock according to the alarm. So they did this for 40 years. So the last day of work, this guy goes out and to thank the guy in the store, like, oh, I just my time in the last 40 years on your clocks, thank you on the street. And the guy goes, oh, it can't be true. So why not? Because I adjust my clocks according to you. So that a little bit, you know, I think like, Darwin, the biologists and geologists are doing the same thing. But it was very important that the reasoning behind here, they go together. And what Mayer did was very ingenious things. Darwin's scientific method, it's much more forensic, he said, than ordinary experimental batch science. So Darwin was not in a, like we saw the guy in Cambridge went to the lab and did an experiment with the protein. He was just looking for clues left behind. That's the reasoning, his method. The evidence before us points back to the probable or possible causes that might explain what produced life in the first place or what produced those clues that lie before us. But that's the reasoning. So, he mentioned historic scientific method. It's a method of multiple competing hypotheses or method of inferring to the best explanation. That's what they did, that's what Darwin did, he put in his book. But what do biologists actually use to determine which explanation is best today? The same thing, the work of Darwin, right? So Lyell argued that in explaining the past, the present is the key. He insisted, this is very important, that we seek explanations based on our knowledge of presently acting causes or causes now in operation. This is very important to see what these guys were thinking, right? Huh, okay. So remember, Mayer went to Cambridge for his PhD in philosophy of science, and that's why he studied deeply. And then clicked on him. Hey. Okay, so what's happening with all we're learning today? Let's use the same reasoning. So he asked the critical question, what is the cause now in operation for the production of digital information that's necessary to build these new forms of life? The answer was intelligence. What we know from our repeated experience that's capable of producing information. Every day, our daily life experience of producing information. Intelligence. What do you see intelligence? Well, hieroglyphic inscriptions, books, sections of computer code, information embedded in radio signals. So this has all. But wait a minute, those guys are reasoning correctly or not? Look at SETI. SETI? You know the program? You don't know anything about it? You fund it. You work hard and pay tax to fund this thing. A bunch of antennas in New Mexico. Right? The rule is that they're looking for extraterrestrial intelligence. That's what that is. It costs a lot of money, and they're paying for this. So what's the reasoning? The reason is the same reasoning. Radio signals from space is just disorganized. Purchases of signals from the stars, completely disorganized. Not like the radio, turn on your radio in the car, and very organized stuff carrying information. So they think, well, if we're all these antennas, if one day we get organized signal from somewhere, bingo, there's life outside. It's the evidence. Isn't that interesting? You find organized radio signal is the proof of intelligence. But find the DNA in the cell is not the proof of intelligence behind it. Something amazing. Another story I like to joke about. You promise your wife you'll take her to an island that no human being has ever stood there, put her foot there, right? So you go there, arrive at this island, and you walk together, enjoying the view. And suddenly, you start going towards the forest right next to this beach, the sand. You find a alright ball. Then you're like, look at this ball here. Somebody was here before. And then her conclusion. She found a clue. A ball made of rubber. Red. Beautiful red. Somebody was here. She didn't see anybody. I wasn't anybody there. There was a clue left. But then you start wait, honey, wait a minute. What happens is this, there's a coconut tree. One storm, the coconut fell and hit a rock that was very fine tip and punched a hole in the coconut. The coconut lays there, ants came, went inside the coconut and ate everything up. Another storm threw this empty coconut and threw around a rubber tree. And now the rubber started dripping inside the hole. And then it fills up, and then the mother storm threw it into the other side of the island where there's a volcano. It warmed up, and some sulfur from the volcano came inside the rubber and polymerized the rubber. Together with some pigments that gave the red color to the rubber. And then another storm threw the coconut against a rock. Shells came out, and here's the ball. What's the chance for that to be true? It's probable cause? If you really say this to your wife, probably she's going to divorce you. I'm not going to stay next to this crazy guy at all. Actually, the scientist who made this, is he calculated all of this stuff. I just made it start short. He said there was 10 steps he came up to create the rubber ball on the island by itself. Each one, it was 1 divided by 10 chance for that. I don't remember the numbers here. But after all multiplying, because it has to multiply, right? So you come up with a number that was like 70, 80 here. In mathematical point of view, every number that's 1, 10, probability that it will happen. So, the citizen, I remember we start talking about philosophy, the climate, the electro climate, the world and society today. It's everything is bent, twisted towards this direction, materially. There's no God. There's no God. Evidence is everywhere around it. There's no, look at this. It's so stupid, you know, to say that the radio waves or the radio frequencies come from space is organized proof of intelligence. They're not. DNA, the biology, you see the life you see around, which is super much more sophisticated than just a radio frequency organized. This is just a, you know, the radio come bursting from the stars and coming to the earth. So he makes an, and I use the same arguments, he makes an idea, you know, a case for idea. He says, it's possible to make a case for idea, use the same exact method of reasoning that Darwin used in Origin of Species. To say that idea is not science, so now he's throwing something in the world, in the verses. If you say, ah, idea is not science, well, so you say that Darwin's argument is also not science or is not scientific. It's exactly the same thing. And that's what he does in both of his books. His books here, his two books, Signature in the Cell and Darwin's Doubt. So that's what I have for today. I'm going to start covering more stuff next Sunday, you know, what's information. And then I'll go back to really start putting things more together. You know, information, process of being formed, information is disposition to inform, using language. It's all everywhere, language, optimal codes, numbers, physics. Information is degree of possibility. Information is defined in terms of probability. Information is the lens of a program. So this is a big discussion just for men to say, oh, what's information? So it'll be three tasks in science. So, search for new knowledge, improve your models and theories, eradication of errors. So we're gonna go deep into that for the next. And all it's gonna be based now on a different guy called Werner Gutt, German engineer. His area is, you know, computing and information. He's been working on this for the last 40 years. Really good.
It seems a word that's missing in there is faith.
Space?
Faith. Right? Because it seems that it takes a lot of faith to believe that all these things are random and that it came together.
More faith than for us to believe in the Bible.
Sure.
Yep.
Sure.
This guy, Romans chapter 1.
Right.
Back to Genesis. It's like, really crazy, you know,
yeah,
to go towards that direction. So, that's what I have for today. I hope I helped from it.
Thank you.
We kind of